Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast, Actual Knowledge and Eureka Limitations Edition. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On December 4th, 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court heard argument in Intel Corporation Investment Policy Committee v. Salima, a case asking what degree of knowledge of a possible violation is necessary to trigger the three-year statute of limitations provided in the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, known as ERISA. Respondent Christopher Salima worked for Intel Corporation from 2010 to 2012, and during that time participated in retirement plans governed by ERISA. In 2015, Salima brought suit against Intel's Investment Policy Committee under various provisions of ERISA, alleging that the committee had invested imprudently and failed to make certain disclosures. Intel moved to dismiss the complaint based on ERISA's statute of limitations, which provides that actions like Salima's may not be commenced more than 3 years after the earliest date on which the plaintiff had actual knowledge of the breach or violation. The district court found that Salima had actual knowledge of the alleged violations more than 3 years before bringing suit and dismissed the case. On appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reversed, concluding that Salima's constructive knowledge of the alleged violations did not rise to the level of actual knowledge necessary to trigger the statute of limitations. It was not sufficient, the court determined, that the relevant facts were available to Salima. He had actually to be aware of those facts. The Ninth Circuit's reasoning on the meaning of actual knowledge conflicted with that of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, however, and the Supreme Court subsequently granted cert to consider whether the ERISA limitations provision bars suit when all of the relevant information was disclosed to the plaintiff by defendants more than 3 years before the plaintiff filed the complaint, but the plaintiff chose not to read or could not recall having read the information. And now, to discuss the case, we have Matthew Rosen, Associate Attorney at Gibson Dunn.
This case involves a straightforward question of statutory interpretation. What does the phrase actual knowledge mean in the context of ERISA's three-year statute of limitations for breaches of fiduciary duties, which runs from the time the plaintiff obtains actual knowledge of the alleged breach? ERISA is the statute that governs employee benefit plans, such as pensions and health care plans. It imposes a number of substantive requirements about how plans should be managed, and it includes remedies for breaches of fiduciary duties and other misconduct. It also imposes a number of disclosure requirements that require plans to provide plan participants with detailed information about the management and the terms of their plans, and to report additional financial information to the Secretary of Labor. The statute includes a two-part statute of limitation provision, codified in 29 U.S.C. section 1113. The statute first imposes a default rule that claims ordinarily must be filed within 6 years of the alleged breach. It then shortens that period to 3 years if the employee obtains actual knowledge of the violation that he is alleging. So the question is, do employees have actual knowledge of information that is disclosed to them directly as in a required plan disclosure, or can they avoid the shorter three-year limitations period by claiming that they did not read or do not remember having read the required disclosures? This question is really critical in a particular class of cases that involves challenging a pension plan's decision about how to invest plan assets. You see cases, for example, where a plan makes a relatively risky investment, seeking a higher rate of return, and it doesn't work out. And then after the fact, with the benefit of hindsight, plan participants challenge the investment as imprudent. Conversely, you see cases that go the exact opposite way, where the plan makes a conservative investment to reduce the risk to plan participants, and predictably, the investment does not yield as great of a rate of return as a riskier investment. And then the plan participants sue, saying it was imprudent to make the more conservative investment. And in these types of cases, it is critical for plans to be able to cut off liability after 3 years, because the longer the period for which participants are able to seek relief, the more hindsight they can have to wait and see how the plan performs over time, and then second-guess the investments, so that they get all the upside if it turns out it was smart to have a risky investment or a conservative investment. But they avoid the downside if it turns out it would have been better to have a riskier or a more conservative investment. In this case, that's exactly what happened. The entity managing the investments allocated a portion of the invested funds to alternative investments in lower risk, hedge funds, and private equity, hoping to reduce risk. And predictably, these investments underperformed relatively riskier options. The plan disclosures disclosed the exact mix of investments, but the plaintiff claimed not to have read them. The Ninth Circuit thus held that a jury would have to decide whether the plaintiff had actual knowledge of the investments, even though that information was included in plan disclosures. And as a result, the Ninth Circuit held that the plan could not rely on the 3-year statute of limitations at the motion to dismiss stage, and the suit could proceed. This case thus illustrates why this interpretation of actual knowledge to include information disclosed to plan participants is so critical, because otherwise, years after the fact, it is extremely difficult to establish that a plan participant had actual knowledge, even if the plan sent the participant all of the information that he would have needed to allege a violation, because all the employee has to do is what he did here, which is to disclaim that he read or remembered having read the information in the disclosures. There are really two main components to the party's arguments. The first is, what does actual knowledge mean? What is its ordinary meaning? Does it have a constant meaning across contexts? And the second is, what does the context tell us here? As for the ordinary meaning, the plaintiff takes the position that actual knowledge is a straightforward phrase that always, in all context, means subjective knowledge. When you're talking about a writing, it means that you've read and understood what was written. The plan, on the other hand, argues that the meaning of the phrase actual knowledge is contextual, and in certain contexts, it can include information that has been provided but not actually read. And one example of this contextual meaning of actual knowledge is that courts often say that willful blindness is equivalent to actual knowledge or is actual knowledge. So if you stick your head in the sand to avoid learning facts that will start the statute of limitations period running or impose some other legal duty on you, you have actual knowledge even though you do not subjectively know the facts that you are blinding yourself to. And there are other contexts in which courts use the phrase actual knowledge to refer to the knowledge that someone has related to a document in their possession, such as a contract. A person who signs a contract can sometimes be said to have actual knowledge of the contract, even if they haven't actually read the contract. The plan's position in this case is that actual knowledge includes both subjectively known facts and information that is contained in a disclosure provided to a person as part of a required disclosure. The plan emphasizes that the phrase in the statute is not actually knew, but had actual knowledge. The use of the word had suggests that possession is important. Having the information in your possession may be sufficient. The parties disagree about whether this kind of knowledge is really constructive as opposed to actual knowledge. The plaintiff says anything that is not subjectively known is not actual knowledge, it's constructive knowledge. And the plan says, no, constructive knowledge is something different. It includes information that is not actually in a person's possession, that they would have to go somewhere else to acquire, but that maybe they are presumed by the law to have a responsibility to go find. The plan's position is that because the meaning of actual knowledge is contextual, you have to look at the specific context of this statute. And the plan points to the ERISA disclosure regime and says, look, this is a detailed statutory scheme in which Congress clearly provided these disclosures for the purposes of ensuring that plan participants would have knowledge of the plans. And there's a lot of legislative history that confirms this. There's also language in the statute that says that plan disclosures should be, quote, written in a manner calculated to be understood by the average plan participant, end quote, and, quote, sufficiently accurate and comprehensive to reasonably apprise such participants of their rights and obligations under the plan. So the statute is clearly contemplating that the purpose of these disclosures is to apprise someone of their rights, to apprise someone of the information contained in them. And it's a reasonable inference to think that Congress would have understood this information to have actually apprised people of their rights. The parties also debate the import of the statutory history. When the three-year limitations period was originally enacted, it contained two parts. The three-year period could be triggered either by actual knowledge or by information in a report filed with the Secretary of Labor. So recall again that ERISA contains detailed disclosures that are sent to plan participants and tell those plan participants about their rights, as well as financial reporting that is filed with the Secretary of Labor. And so this statute, when originally enacted, provided that filing a report with the Secretary could trigger the statute of limitations, even if no one had actual knowledge of the information in those reports. In 1987, Congress repealed the provision that tied the three-year statute of limitations to reports filed with the Secretary. The plaintiffs look at this and say, the prior version of the provision was a constructive knowledge provision. Congress repealed it. That shows that Congress did not want constructive knowledge to count towards the statute of limitations. So they say, therefore, actual knowledge must mean something different than constructive knowledge, and it must be limited to subjective knowledge. The plan looks at the same sequence of events and sees strong evidence that actual knowledge must include plan disclosures. And the reason is that it would make no sense for Congress to pass a statute of limitations that is triggered by reports sent to someone else, the Secretary of Labor, but is not triggered by reports or disclosures sent directly to the plaintiffs themselves. And so it must be that Congress understood required plan disclosures to plan participants to be a source of actual knowledge, unlike reports filed with the Secretary, and therefore covered by the actual knowledge provisions. That's the only interpretation that explains why Congress would have separately called out reports filed with the Secretary, but not called out disclosures sent to plan participants, even though you would think people would have greater knowledge of the latter. So having laid out the basic arguments that both parties make, let me end with a prediction. Oral argument was held on December 4th, and it appears that several of the justices were skeptical of the plan's position. Justices Kavanaugh and Roberts were concerned that maybe nobody reads ERISA plan disclosures. Justice Ginsburg suggested that the plan's position arguably reads the word actual out of the statute. Several other justices asked questions along similar lines. And both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch suggested at various points that this question might be better left to Congress. So it seems likely that the court is poised to rule for the plaintiff and to hold that plan disclosures do not create actual knowledge for purposes of ERISA's three-year statute of limitations unless those disclosures are actually read and understood by the recipients. At the same time, the fact that the court granted cert in this case suggests to me that there is some awareness among the justices of the need to rein in this type of hindsight-based challenge to the investment decisions made by a pension plan. I think we're likely to see some language in the decision in this case addressing the difficulties of certifying a class action in this type of case when doing so would require individualized inquiries into whether each plan participant read the relevant disclosures. And I think we're likely to see additional cases in this area in future terms.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.